mean, I could say this almost without qualification, right from the moment I arrived in the West in the early 50s until the present. Initially, there's always a sense in which, as an Arab and obviously as a Palestinian, you feel in some way criminalized or delinquent. So powerful is the definition of you as somebody who's outside the pale, I mean, whose sole sort of purpose in life is to kill Jews.
Edward Said is one of America's most distinguished literary scholars and critics. He is in exile in the very particular sense that the country in which he was born and spent his childhood no longer exists. Although most of his time is devoted to academic work, writing and lecturing on literature and music, Said's other great preoccupation in exile is the story of Palestine and the Palestinians. Said was born in 1935 into a wealthy Christian Palestinian family. 13 years later, with the declaration of the State of Israel, the Said family gave up their home in Jerusalem and settled in Egypt and then in Lebanon. Edward was sent to English schools, first in Cairo and later in the United States. He studied at Princeton and Harvard and went on to become professor of comparative literature at Columbia University in New York. Said is a member of the Palestine National Council and a supporter of the PLO. In March, he was invited to Washington to advise George Shultz on the Palestinian question.
I don't have any Arab colleagues. Most of my colleagues are, in fact, Jews or Americans who have no connection with the Middle East. And with them, I mean, my relationships on the whole, I would say, are thoroughly normal and perfectly pleasant. I mean, I think there's a general sort of way of being in the academic world that tends to reduce conflict, so that with Jewish colleagues who may feel strongly about it, we simply never talk about it. The worst aspect of it is, of course, the occasional threat of violence. I mean, my office has been raided and vandalized. I've received death threats and phone messages that are, you know, quite unpleasant. So there's that. I mean, there's the hint of violence around there. And I suppose, in general, I do feel, given the atmosphere surrounding Palestine and Palestinians, in New York in particular, I do feel, whether anything is said overtly or not, I feel as if I'm a delinquent. Sort of before anything gets going, I am somehow guilty as charged.
Along with other left-wing Arab and Jewish intellectuals, Said appears in several academic blacklists as an enemy of Israel.
I think, to be honest with you, my first inclination is to be vaguely amused by this, because, I mean, I must say, as a group who's supposed to be the enemies of Israel, we seem, to me anyway, to be not a very formidable, enemy. But then, you know, you get angry because, I mean, it's obviously meant to be intimidating and to threaten you and to obviously, you know, smear your reputation that you're in. There's always something suggestive about it, that you're in the pay of somebody else or that you're really a terrorist. You're an agent for terrorism or this sort of thing. I've been called that, actually, quite frequently by polemicists and even other scholars who prefer to do that rather than, you know, try to engage with my ideas. But I think the overall feeling that I have is one, when I think about it, you know, for any length of time, is one of you know, astonishment that at the sort of injustice of it. You know, here I am, a child of a people that's been sort of kicked out of its own land, forbidden to return. I mean, that is to say, most of the authors of these books, for example, are sometimes students who are employed by these agencies to spy on me and to find out what I say and this sort of thing. And if they're Jewish, just by fact of being Jewish, born in New York of a Jewish parent, they're entitled to go to Israel, or Palestine, as I call it, become Israeli citizens at any time that they wish. I was born there, my father was born there, my grandfather, etc. And I can't return. I don't have the same right. I mean, the law of return somehow covers them And my people, my family, were kicked out of there. And they're writing books about me, accusing me of terrorism. I mean, the enormity of the whole thing just baffles me at the same time that it strikes me very strongly.
Zionist settlement in Palestine gathered momentum after World War I, but met with little serious opposition from the native population until the 1930s. From then on, the British government would find its mandate increasingly unworkable, having made conflicting promises to the Jews and to the Palestinian Arabs. In 1917, the Balfour Declaration appeared to safeguard the interests of both. Not so a memorandum written 2 years later. The four great powers are committed to Zionism, and Zionism, be it right or wrong, good or bad, is rooted in age-long traditions, in present needs, in future hopes of far profounder import than the desires and prejudices of the 700,000 Arabs who now inhabit that ancient land.
My mother was born and lived in Nazareth and married my father there in 1932. My father came from Jerusalem. And it wasn't really until about, I would say, maybe 10 or 15 years ago that she told me, it's quite an extraordinary experience that she had. When she married my father, they had to register the wedding. And together, they went to the Palestine government mandatory office. The official there was an Englishman. And my mother said that she watched him sort of rip up her passport. And he, in amazement, my mother said, well, why are you doing this? He said, well, now you'll travel on your husband's passport. And she said, yes, but I mean, why did I have to lose mine in that way? And he said, well, because your place and this card is going to be given to a Jewish immigrant to Palestine. And the idea was that her identity was just, you know, just by a simple act of tearing up a piece of paper was taken away from her by a foreigner. And she lived with the consequences of that for 30 years. And then she became, in the 50s, in the late 50s, a Lebanese citizen. And of course, she's not Lebanese, she's Palestinian.
At Haifa, the last British troops leave Palestine. And very few of them can have been sorry. As the tanks and soldiers went aboard the transports, the thought that a difficult and thankless job had been well done must have mattered much less than the prospect of going home. Union Jack was hauled down and the doors closed for good on the British mandate. Later in the day, Israel's flag was flying over Haifa and the Prime Minister, Mr. Ben-Gurion, was there for the taking over ceremony. A sad chapter had closed and the world hopes that you know will be able to find a satisfactory solution to the Palestine problem.
There's a place on the application that says place of birth, so I put down Jerusalem, Palestine. Then I get a passport back saying Jerusalem, Israel. I then go into the passport office and say, look, I wasn't born in Israel. I said, where were you born? Palestine. Well, Palestine doesn't exist anymore. So I say, yeah, but I was born there, and Israel didn't exist when I was born. So back and forth until finally I get a passport that just says place of birth, Jerusalem, without any country listed. I don't think it would work for any other city, because Jerusalem is, I suppose, a rather special place.
Thank you.
Palestine is not an ordinary place. I'm sure where oppression occurs, like South Africa or Chile and so on, those are not ordinary places either. But Palestine, I think, has something more. It's a place where religions were manufactured and where all kinds of revelations are alleged to have occurred. And it has a kind of density and resonance that virtually no other place in the world has. And it's also a very small place and very crowded. And that crisscrossing, that sort of fabric of claims and counterclaims, interests me a great deal. The question, I mean, the political and even philosophical question is, why is it, you know, that visions of community in a land that is as dense as this have tended not to triumph, and what has triumphed instead is visions of exclusivism, you know, to say, well, it's our country and only ours, and we want to push everybody out.
The scene is near Jericho, one of the camps for Arab refugees. The story is one of destitution. For these people, as the result of the war in Palestine, have either fled or been expelled from their homes and their livelihood. Moreover, the Arab refugee problem is a very big one, for those in need are said to number over 500,000. But relief to be effective must be speedy.
It's been very important to try to understand, for me, tremendous appeal of Zionism to the European mind. And I would say that there are really two very powerful and compelling reasons for that appeal. One of them is, the first reason is that Zionism is appears to be a movement and an ideology that sort of gathered together the remnants and the kind of remains of a shattered community of people who had historically been oppressed and abused and discriminated and persecuted in the West, and gathered them together into a very powerful movement which created a new country. It had all the elements of a kind of phoenix, you know, rising from the ashes. And it also had the appeal of the creation of a new state, which is, I think, very central to the European consciousness. Because, you know, a lot like, for example, the American experiment of Europe, that is to say, sending out people to America to create a new country. And obviously it explains the peculiarly close connection between America and Israel. There's this tremendously attractive idea of starting out afresh, of starting with a clean slate, of building a new country, making the desert bloom. I mean, it has all the elements also of miracle. And that's very, very appealing, I think.
Said's ability to look at the West from the East and the East from the West, having been educated in both, informs the themes and arguments of much of his work. In his best-known and most influential book, Said examined 19th-century Western attitudes to the Orient and Oriental society.
I was struck by the consistency and the coherence of pictures or representations of the East, or the Orient, as I called it, in a lot of European culture, you know, say 19th-century French paintings by Gérôme, for instance, or novelistic writing, say, in the work of people like Flaubert and Disraeli, say, and sort of scholarly writing by linguists and historians and anthropologists and sociologists. The consistency of the picture that emerged of something called the Orient, and the extent to which a lot of this material contributed to creating a kind of unified image of the Orient, which had a very set character, which had a particular set of characteristics that keep coming back, you know, sensuality, despotism, wealth, promise, cruelty. And so I tried to show how this collective portrait of the Orient grew in the 19th century and became as consistent as it was. And I related it to, and I think this was one of the things that was quite controversial, I related it to European power. I was saying, really, that there is no such thing as the Orient. The Orient is much more complicated, much more varied, much more heterogeneous, and above all, much more detailed than any of these grand generalizations about, well, we know that Orientals tend to think in certain ways. That, for example, one of the things I mentioned in the early part of the book was Lord Cromer, who's saying the Oriental mind is different from ours. It is not capable of grasping Western logic. You know, an Egyptian, for example, cannot walk on the sidewalk, he would say. You know, he has to walk on the street. That's a function of the mind. And I was saying all of that's absolute nonsense. You know, you can't make these generalizations and then pretend that they are factual or scientific generalizations. They are rooted in rule.
What do you think of when you think of an Arab? Somebody with a towel on their head. Camel and maybe some sand. Want to throw a pyramid in there? Well, guess who's here? Right on our stage. This itself would not have been possible not long ago. Edward Said joins us, professor of English, Columbia University, member of the Palestine National Council, to which umbrella organization belongs, the PLO. You were born in Jerusalem and raised in Egypt and Palestine. You are currently a United States citizen. Kenneth Jacobson, director of Middle Eastern Affairs for the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. You don't want to talk to Mr. Said unless the PLO declines or moves away from its stated policy of destroying Israel. If the PLO doesn't recognize Israel's right to exist, then I suppose there's some passionate people who might think you are betraying Israel to even appear with the man. Is it that bad out there now?
It's not that bad out there now. It's been bad for a while in the sense that you have to have something to talk about. When someone says to you, his basic assumption in speaking to you is that you don't have a right to exist, where do you go from
it's
there?
It's off-putting, yes. Mr. Said, Professor Said, how do you respond to that?
No, I think the basic thing is whether people want to talk about peace and about the real issue, which is the land, and whether it can be divided
but
to
accommodate people.
But I think
I hear him saying he might be willing to discuss that if the PLO would acknowledge Israel's legitimate right to exist.
Well, I mean, what about the Israeli recognition of the Palestinian people as a political factor, as a community with a claim?
But I won't marry you unless you love me, and
I won't say unless you say it first,
and now we're never going to get married.
No, I'm not saying that. I said, why not have a mutual recognition in which the people recognize each other?
Perhaps we can do something today. We have here a wonderful opportunity. Two moderates from either side sitting together, hopefully talking to each other.
Well, I mean, he doesn't accept
it. You don't want to be called a moderate?
We want to talk to each other.
I'd be happy to be called a moderate, but I really question whether anyone who's supporting the PLO can be defined as moderate.
Well, can I say something?
We are not here to score points.
No, I think the main point.
We are here to talk about matters of life and death, matters of war and peace.
But don't squelch the nets. This is a natural expression of enthusiasm. They want to save babies,
too. Could I just say
Professor
something?
Professor
Said,
sir.
Look, I think the main point is if you want to negotiate some kind of peace with justice, you cannot legislate in advance who's going to represent whom. The Israeli position and the position of the ADL is that we are not only entitled to decide what to talk about, but we're going to decide who to talk to. Now, the Palestinians have their own representatives, and nobody has found any other representatives for the Palestinians except the PLO. Now, we don't say we will not talk to the Israeli government because they don't, after all, it was the Israeli government, A, that dispossessed the Palestinians, that destroyed Lebanon in 1982, killed...
The Israeli government... Lebanon has been destroying itself since
500
years.
The same thing.
Why
isn't it the same thing? Just hang on one second. Why couldn't the PLO decline to talk to Israel because Ariel Sharon, a duly authorized member of the... presided over the bombing of...
I'm saying it's a faulty argument.
Why couldn't Russia refuse to talk to us because we bombed Libya? It goes on and on.
I'm not saying
this is easy, but don't we save more babies by at least getting into the same room?
We have to talk.
Get into the same room.
The problem is it didn't start yesterday. It didn't start...
I think the really dramatic change, which I again read about, was, I think, 67. The War of 67, where the entire map of the Arab world changed. And for the first time, Israel, which had been confined largely to the small boundaries of the state, had sort of overflowed into Jordan, taken the West Bank and Gaza, taken the Sinai and the Golan Heights. And reading about this in America, watching it on the television, almost entirely from the viewpoint of a horrified and shamed victim, because then it was perfectly clear that I was an Arab. I mean, I couldn't go on simply being an undergraduate with this strange, to my American friends and colleagues, you know, the strange cachet of being somehow from the Arab world, maybe from Egypt, that the whole idea of being an Arab and then beginning to discover that that meant being a Palestinian, that all really came to the fore in 1967. I mean, that was, I would say, the great explosion. And it had a tremendous effect on my sort of psychological and even intellectual processes, because I discovered then that I had to rethink my my life and my identity, even though it had been so sort of sheltered and built up in this completely artificial way. I had to rethink it from the start. And that was a process that really is continuing. I mean, it hasn't ended for me.
In his 1979 book, The Question of Palestine, Said quotes the Israeli general Moshe Dayan. "We came to this country, which was already populated by Arabs, and we are establishing a Hebrew, that is a Jewish state here. In considerable areas of the country, we bought the land from the Arabs. Jewish villages were built in the place of Arab villages. You don't even know the names of these Arab villages, and I don't blame you, because the geography books no longer exist. Not only do the books not exist, the Arab villages are not there either. There is not one place built in this country that did not have a former Arab population."
The great problem that we face as a people is that we're being told by the Israelis that in a certain sense we don't really exist, that the continuity of our existence in Palestine, that our history, our identity, is sort of manageable by Israeli historians, by propagandists, by politicians, is manageable as something else. The Arabs of Judea and Samaria, Begin used to call us, two-legged beasts, terrorists, everything but not Palestinians. We were there. I mean, you can't do more than that. But it's so indecent and humiliating an exercise to have to say that we do exist. In, that is to say, there were villages, Palestinian villages, there were Palestinian cities, there was a Palestinian society, there were Palestinian people before 1948 who were Arab and who formed a society, underdeveloped or whatever you want to call it, but it was there, which abruptly and dramatically in the middle part of 1948 was shattered, dismantled, destroyed by the Zionists.
There's also a question of how Zionism conceives Arabs, and it has become current for Arabs to call Zionism a racial, a racist ideology. Now, what, Patrick Seal, is the basis of that charge?
Well, I know it's a charge which created outrage when it was first raised. I think at the UN they tried to dub Zionism as a racist thing. But you see, unfortunately, I think there is something in it. I mean, much as one hates to say so, but if you just look at some of the statements, say, of a man like Begin, I mean, he's always ranting about Jewish blood and how precious it is, with the implication, of course, that Arab blood is much less precious. And he says things like, Palestinians are animals walking on two paws. Or you remember his chief of staff at the time, Raful Eitan, talked about Palestinians being cockroaches in a bottle. Now, he talks about blood libel against the Jews. Or, of course, his famous phrase at the time of the Sabra and Shatila massacre. He said, if Goyim kill Goyim, what concern is it of ours? Now that, it seems to me, is an absolutely racial remark. Now, of course, this is not the only basis of that evidence. And there's a great deal more, and particularly, of course, the treatment of Jews from Arab countries in Israel. And they would be the first, I think, to say that they had been treated in a racialist way. I've just been reading a very interesting book.
I thoroughly disagree with you.
Right.
Now, of course, you can mention, I can give you a list of 24 other loudmouth generals in Israel who have said outrageous things, but this you can say about every country. I mean, in this country there are no loudmouth politicians and loudmouth generals. Surely I would not make generalizations about England on the basis of what a couple of politicians have said about the West Indian immigrants and so forth.
Is Begin just a random politician, or does he represent a
Begin,
trend?
Well, Begin does not represent a trend. Begin, I think, is a very sad consequence of 40 or 50 years of Arab-Israeli wars. About Mr. Begin and about Mr. Raful that you had mentioned, I think I would say, by way of generalization, that the Arab extremists, who are our worst enemies, by the way, they have at least already achieved one great victory over us, in that they have succeeded to infect us, or some of us, with their brutality and their extremism. This, I think, is a consequence of 50 and 60 years of war.
I think what Patrick is saying, in another way, I'd like to reformulate and say that had there been in the United States, for example, immigration laws which said that only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants can emigrate and get a citizenship, then you as a Jew and I as a Palestinian would object. Now, the same law, in an inverse formulation of the same law, which says that only a Jew can emigrate to Israel, whereas a Palestinian who is born there and can...
This law was passed barely 5 or 6 years after the gates of Auschwitz had closed.
No, I understand
when
that.
When everybody had seen that the Jews were the only people who were thrown in the gas chambers because they were the only people in Europe who had absolutely no control, not even the slightest measure of control over their fate.
But doesn't
the Jews convince themselves, rightly or wrongly, that this had happened because they did not have a territory, because they did not have any power? This law was passed.
Let's put this question more precisely. How exactly do you justify, not in 47 or 48, when the Auschwitz case seems to be unanswerable, but how do you justify in 1987, a law of return which entitles a Jew from London or from Manchester to return to enjoy rights and citizenship protection in Israel, which are denied to Arabs born in that country, born on that territory?
Try as he or she might, a Palestinian finds it very difficult. I won't say impossible, but I think it's very, very hard. And I think most Palestinians are like most people. It's very hard for the Palestinian who feels himself or herself to have been the victim of injustice by Jews, Israeli Jews, to sympathize or imaginatively incorporate the history of the Holocaust and say, well, we forgive them for what they did. I mean, after all, they suffered this enormous, this colossal historical tragedy. The Jews did. And the fact that they are evicting us from our territory, that they are placing us under occupation, that they're treating us as third-class citizens, that they are killing our people, that they are confining us to camps, etc., 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 we understand. Nobody can understand that. I mean, you can grasp the first fact, the fact of the Holocaust, but you can't translate that into your own doom. I mean, as another person, as the doom that is visited on you by those people. I mean, it's very, very hard to do that. On the other hand, I really genuinely believe that it's incredibly important for Palestinians to try to understand what it is that what force it is that we're dealing with. You know, I made a great effort to go and see Shoah, you know, the Lanzmann film about the Holocaust, which was shown recently in New York. You know, it's 9.5 or 10 hours. And I'm certain that that my wife and I were the only two Arabs in the audience when we saw it. And I could feel it all, you know, and I understood the enormous horror, and I was aghast at it. I mean, because I understood it as a kind of European or Western kind of Holocaust, which it was. But then when I came to the point of saying, well, what does this mean to me? It means to me that this is the legitimization of what has happened to us as a people, the Palestinians. And then, you know, it's a paradox, you can call it. You can call it an antinomy. You can call it a tragedy. But it doesn't lessen one's will, and this is the second point, it doesn't lessen your will to struggle against it. This is an example of Palestinian black humor. It's something that was broadcast on the Israeli radio during the summer of 82 as an instance of how a Palestinian captured quote-unquote terrorist is interrogated by somebody. But it was then transcribed by a friend and given to me. And it was played many times on the radio in Beirut as a form of entertainment of how the Palestinian, who was in fact the captured, turns the table on his Israeli captor, who's interrogating him. And this is what happens on the radio. So the Israeli broadcaster says, "Your name." The captured Palestinian says, "My name is Ahmad Abdel Hamid Abu Sitti." The Israeli man says, "What's your movement name?" "My movement name is Abu Layl, Father of Night." "Tell me, Mr. Abu Layl, to which terrorist organization do you belong?" He responds, "I belong to the Popular Front for the Liberation, Tahrir. I mean, terrorization of Palestine, Tahrir in Arabic. And when did you get involved in the terrorist organization?" "When I first became aware of terrorism." "And what was your mission in South Lebanon?" "My mission was terrorism. In other words, we would enter villages and just terrorize. And whenever there were women and children, we would terrorize. Everything and all we did was terrorism." By this time, of course, the Israeli is very happy that this man is saying all of these things. "And did you practice terrorism out of belief in a cause or simply for money?" Palestinian, "No, by God, just for money. What kind of cause is this anyway? Why, is there still a cause? We sold out a long time ago. Tell me, where do the terrorist organizations get their money?" "From anyone who will spare money for terrorism. In other words, from the Arab regimes that support terrorism." Of course, he's now giving him exactly what he wants, but I mean to such a degree that it's... "What's your opinion," the Israeli says, "what's your opinion of the terrorist Arafat?" Palestinian, "I swear he's the greatest terrorist of all. He's the one who sold us and the cause out. His whole life is terrorism." "What's your opinion of the way the Israeli Defense Forces have conducted themselves?" Palestinian, "On my honor, we thank the Israeli Defense Forces for their good treatment to all us terrorists. Do you have any advice for other terrorists who are still terrorizing and attacking the IDF?" Palestinian responds, "My advice to them is to surrender their arms to the IDF, and what they'll find there is the best possible treatment. Lastly, Mr. Terrorist, would you like to send a message to your family?" Palestinian, "I'd like to assure my family and friends that I'm in good health, and I'd also like to thank the enemy broadcasting facility for letting me speak out like this." "You mean the Kol Israel, the voice of Israel?" Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. Naturally, sir."
That's, of course, very amusing and very ironic. But I do need to know where you stand on this question of terrorism, the killing of innocent people, men, women, children, by Palestinians.
Well, I think it's a horrible thing. I've always been against it. I've always felt that the emphasis on what has been called armed struggle has been indiscriminate and sometimes foolishly and, in a political sense, stupidly relied on. But I never, never will concede that the essence of the Palestinian struggle, as the Israelis say, is terrorism. I think that the Palestinians, by and large, to a fantastic degree, have waged war against a merciless occupier, a person, a state, an army, an enemy that has dispossessed them and has done far, far worse to Palestinians than any Palestinians have done to Israelis. And I think one must always make the distinction between terrorism, which is, as I say, random and stupid and unpolitical, and the struggle against an oppressor. And I think in that particular distinction, I'm obviously for the latter and totally against the former. At the same time, as I say, that I myself have always been made uncomfortable by the use of arms in this very ugly and long-standing struggle. But I certainly must say that I've been much more impressed by the cruelty and, above all, the extent of Palestinian suffering than at the hands of the Israelis than the other way around. I mean, the ratio is infinitely greater. The Israelis make no secret of it, that they've always killed Palestinian civilians, sometimes at the rate of 100 to 1 Israeli death. So I think, given that, I think the use of the word terrorism is a mistake.
That seems very clear, but also very cold and unfeeling, one has to say.
I'm not sure what you mean, unfeeling.
Well, to say that bombing schools or
school buses is not political.
No, I mean, by that I mean it's wanton murder, is what I'm saying. If that's being cold, then I'm being cold. I'm simply saying that it all violence of this sort is ugly. I don't myself believe in the purifying quality of violence as it's sometimes alleged to have. I don't believe in cults of arms and blood and so on and so forth. So that any act of that sort horrifies me. And I've grown up in an area which has had more than its share of violence in my lifetime. But the best that can be said about it is that it's advanced a political goal. I mean, certainly the Zionists have used it and brought it, in fact, to the area. Terrorism, as we know it today, the planting of bombs in marketplaces and so on and so forth, was, in fact, introduced into the Middle East by the Zionists in the 20s. So I'm against that, but what I'm also trying to say is that some people will say that it advances a political cause. I myself don't feel that it does. I mean, I think it attracts attention to it. But the net result of Zionist terrorism and violence in the first third of the 20th century has brought forth, to my mind, the anomaly, the horrific and unacceptable status in the Middle East today of the State of Israel, which is in fact an armed garrison state, which now exports more arms and distributes violence all around the world, vastly disproportionate to its size. I mean, in that respect, I think it's a horrible cycle of violence. But in it all, I think the Palestinian is the victim. There's no question about that.
After 2 months' siege and bombardment by the Israel Defense Forces, the surviving PLO fighters left West Beirut to be dispersed in the few Arab countries still willing to receive and support them. Israel had invaded Lebanon with the aim of destroying the Palestinian state within a state which had grown up under the leadership of Yasser Arafat and the PLO. This was not a purely military matter. The PLO had established schools, hospitals, and other institutions which the Israeli government wished to see removed from Lebanon.
In the latter part of August of 1982, I was in, of all places, Chicago. My family, my mother, my sisters, my wife's family, many, many friends, were all in Beirut. So the actual end of the war was symbolized by the Palestinians, the PLO fighters, leaving Beirut by sea. And it meant a number of very different things. One, obviously, was the irony of the situation in which Palestinians were put out to sea in boats. And for years, we had heard it said that we were the ones who were trying to drive the Jews into the sea. And here, before the world's eyes, could be seen the spectacle of Palestinians being sent out into the sea, further away from the land that they came from. The second significance to me, watching it again at a great distance, was that I knew instinctively that this was the end of a very important phase of Palestinian life, and that it would never be the same again. Because Beirut the Palestinian presence in Beirut from the early 70s, for about a decade, from the early 70s to the early 80s, was the first time, I would say, in our national existence when we had, in fact, constituted a kind of substitute or ersatz Palestine in, alas, a sovereign country, Lebanon, and had led a kind of in relatively independent existence with institutions and so on. And it was the first time that we had, in fact, constructed a kind of Palestine for ourselves. But everyone knew it wasn't in Palestine, it was somewhere else. I mean, I'd say that's the quintessential Palestinian irony, that we're always doing things that we would like to have done in Palestine but couldn't, but we're doing them somewhere else at the wrong time and, you know, causing a lot of trouble for others. I mean, that's got to be said too. And of course, the main significance beyond those two other things, is the tremendous sadness of, you know, of an uncertainty of what is to come afterwards. Knowing, for example, that not one of the Arab countries, that Arab friends, if you like, were, with a very few, usually individual exceptions, unable to come to the aid of this quite, I thought, quite heroic small force of people who had no heavy arms to speak of, no air force, no navy, no tanks, none of that stuff, who fought off this immense Israeli concentration, usually who depended on sort of phantoms and cluster bombs and things, you know, remote control devices to kill, you know, just kill large concentrations of Palestinians. Beirut really became, it became the last of the places of my early years, Palestine, Egypt, and Lebanon were the third, to which I could no longer return. And its disappearance was of immense and terribly sad significance for me. And second, it was also the loss of a place that had been immensely, immensely generous and hospitable to a whole generation of Arab exiles, not only Palestinians, but Iraqis and Syrians and Egyptians and Sudanese and so on. And it was the expatriate capital of the Arab world, and it was over. In that respect, Beirut really now stands for a kind of nostalgia, it represents a kind of nostalgia and an intellectual and political and personal development, which is really utterly closed, shut off in a way that is so sad to behold, particularly as it seems to continue. I mean, it's not as if it happened and it was over. But the news of Beirut, as we hear it, and since my mother still lives in Beirut, is that of a city that's sort of chopping itself and bleeding to death. The state of exile is a pretty serious and unpleasant experience. I mean, somebody's been sent away, banished, severed from his or her native place it was traditionally considered to be one of the worst fates. I mean, you could never return to your patria, to your place of origin, to your country, and so on, your native soil. And I think it's right to concentrate, therefore, on the dispossessions, on the diminutions and the unhappinesses of all that, the impermanence, the loss, and so on. On the other hand, you could say, well, since exile is, as I believe it is, a permanent state, in other words, it's something that cannot be gotten over, it can't be restored, you can't restore yourself to a state of, it's like the fall in, you know, from paradise, you can't really go back. In that case, what is it that exile affords you that wouldn't be the case for somebody who always stayed at home and, you know, went through the daily routine? And I think there, what the essential privilege of exile is to have not just one set of eyes, but half a dozen, each of them corresponding to the places you've been. And therefore, instead of looking at an experience as a single unitary thing, it's always got at least two aspects. I mean, the aspect of the person who's looking at it and has always seen it, okay, looking at it now and seeing it now. And then, as you're looking at it now, you could remember what it would have been like to look at something similar in that other place from which you came. So you can bring the two experiences together, and there's always a kind of a doubleness to that experience. And the more places you've been, the more displacements you've gone through, as every exile does, because every situation is a new one, you start out each day anew, the more experience seems to be multiple and complex and composite and interesting for that reason.
We start with an exclusive report from inside the Palestinian refugee camp of Bourj al-Barajneh in West Beirut. It's been under siege since the end of October, and women and girls have to run a daily gauntlet of sniper fire to get food and medical supplies.
The three main camps are Sabra and Shatila, where Palestinians were massacred by right-wing Christian militias after the Israeli invasion in 1982. And further down, in the southern suburbs of Beirut, Bourj al-Barajneh, covering about a square mile. It's been held under siege for over 5 months by Amal militiamen and Shiite Muslims in the Lebanese army, who don't want the PLO to re-establish a power base in Lebanon. Bourj al-Barajneh, like other Palestinian refugee camps, was built by people who fled the new state of Israel in 1948. It's always been a sort of state within a state itself.
You become incapable, really, of reacting further. You just take it in and say, that's where we are. But I think it encourages in me, and I think in most Palestinians who have watched or heard about this, the will to resist further. I mean, that you know, we mustn't let this simply take place and these people be effaced. We must continue to fight and to struggle towards something that will take us out of this, and that Bourj al-Barajneh and Shatila and Sabra and all the other Tel Azat, I mean, there's a whole string of these catastrophes in our histories, have to end up somewhere that isn't just another catastrophe.
Above all else, they know the cost of food that comes from the outside cannot be counted in Lebanese pounds. It is paid for in blood, an 18-year-old victim of the death passage having paid for bread with her life.
Well, I think to a large degree it is their fault. I mean, I have no doubt that it's the case that the Palestinians' fault is that they exist. And wherever they exist, whether they exist in former Palestine, now Israel, occupied territories, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, and elsewhere, they are a reminder, because they are extremely politically conscious. They are people who are simply not going to go back on their national demand, which is self-determination, a society and a place of their own, so that by their very existence, which is their fault, technically speaking, they are a provocation to all the societies and all the states in the region and in the world elsewhere, who have tried to eliminate them or say that these people should be settled elsewhere, they should give up on this. Now, we now have Israel, we now have Lebanon, we now have Jordan, let's not have another state. So the stubborn resistance of the Palestinian to say, no, I'm the one who was driven off the land and dispossessed and dislocated. And just that very fact to say that you're a Palestinian today in Lebanon or elsewhere is really to incur the wrath of your host or whoever thinks of you as a problem. And I think it's as simple as that. This is not a war to prevent Yasser Arafat or the PLO from establishing a base. This is a war to exterminate the Palestinian national identity. It's as simple as that.
On the day the talk was supposed to be of peace, the violence continued with renewed fury. The Israelis had moved hundreds of additional soldiers and policemen into sensitive areas in an attempt to keep the lid on the uprising whilst Mr. Schultz was starting his peace mission. They failed. They particularly wanted to keep Jerusalem quiet whilst Mr. Schultz was in the capital. That failed too. In this incident, border police clashed with a group of American tourists who berated them for roughing up a passing Palestinian youth. The border police, responsible for some of the worst excesses in a lengthening catalogue of Israeli brutality, displayed little regard for the tourists' protests. They gassed them. In Hebron, with feelings running high at the funeral of a man who died of asphyxiation in a cloud of gas earlier in the day, the soldiers moved in to break up the funeral procession. When gas failed to do that, live ammunition was used. And there was fresh evidence that despite assurances that they've been given orders to the contrary, Israeli forces are still meting out their own summary justice. This youth sampled it just north of Jerusalem. And outside Nablus, one of the worst cases of brutality yet witnessed. The youths had been throwing stones. They were caught. According to the soldiers' orders, they should have been arrested and detained. In fact, the soldiers spent 40 minutes systematically beating the youths until they'd broken their arms. Palestinians say this is happening with increasing frequency.
What do the events of the last few months mean to you?
I mean, I sense there, first of all, as one of the people in Gaza said, that
fear has been forbidden. I mean, nobody seems to be afraid of armed Israelis, and the subsequent beatings and the brutality that have been on the screen has not deterred Palestinians from a rather disciplined and intelligent mass action of one sort or another. I mean, you know, throwing stones are only part of it. The other is just endlessly disrupting the occupation in one way or another, so that they never know what's coming next, and they can never sort of rest assured that they've got control of the territory. So there's that for us. For me, I mean, as a Palestinian, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of attention now focused on the Palestinians, who they are, what they're doing, etc. Whereas we had always been kind of secondary and shadowy figures. We still are to a certain degree. Most people don't know who, I mean, they're faceless people. But still there's some sense in which, you know, somebody like myself is now called upon frequently to talk about this, to express, to explain, to interpret in a way that hadn't been true before. And there's a kind of heroism here which has communicated itself to us all, so that everybody feels he's willing to, he or she, is willing to make sacrifices.
Shortly before the uprising began, Said accepted an invitation to lecture at Bir Zeit University in the Israeli-occupied West Bank.
I was prepared to go. We were all going. I was going with my wife and two children. We had reserved seats on British Airways to London and then London to Tel Aviv. And about 10 days ago, I started to get signals that I'd better not come. And then 3-4 days ago, in mid-March, I got a clipping sent to me from Davar, which is an Israeli newspaper, in which it was suggested that by the Prime Minister's office that should I appear at the airport, I would not be admitted. So in the circumstances, it seemed to me rather quixotic to try, because it would probably mean, you know, being sent back. So I just didn't. But it was a blow, because we had looked forward to it, and I had wanted my children, who have never been there, to see it. I particularly wanted my son, who is named after my father, to go to the school where I and my father both went, St. George's, and see his grandfather's name on the first 11 for cricket and football, you know, in 1906 or whatever it was. But it didn't work out. Maybe we'll go at some later date, but it doesn't look too probable now.
Exile. The facts of my birth are so distant and strange as to be about someone I've heard of rather than someone I know. Nazareth, my mother's town. Jerusalem, my father's. The pictures I see of these places today display the same produce, presented in the same carelessly plentiful way, in the same rough wooden cases. The same people walk by, looking at the same posters and trinkets, concealing the same secrets, searching for the same profits, pleasures, and goals. The same as what? There's little that I can truly remember about Jerusalem and Nazareth. Little that is specific, little that has the irreducible durability of tactile, visual, or auditory memories that concede nothing to time. Little that is not confused with pictures I have seen, or scenes I've glimpsed elsewhere in the Arab world. Palestine is exile, dispossession. The inaccurate memories of one place slipping into vague memories of another. The story of Palestine cannot be told smoothly. Instead, the past, like the present, offers only occurrences and coincidences. Random.